the pretty things.
Meeting will come to order. Since we have seven bills, and I think the authors are all still here, we're going to move right ahead. And I think the first thing we need to do is apologize to Lake Titlow for misspelling the on our agenda. It is O-E. Is that correct?
Madam Chair, it's actually O-W.
O-W. So we were okay.
Wow.
Welcome to the committee, and Representative Morrow, I will move House File 471, and you are.
Thank you, Madam Chair. We've had a long discussion about the spelling of the lake. In the city of Gaylord, it is spelled with an E, and on all the local maps, it's spelled with an E, but when we came to GIS, we found out that on the state maps, there's a W. So that's another matter for another day. But I'm proud to be here with two testifiers to talk about efforts to clean up Lake Titlow. I won't spend a great deal of time talking about it, but there are three components to the House file. One is for study for pre-design and design of holding ponds. The second is to assist the city of Gaylord to pay for stormwater runoff pipes to prevent stormwater runoff into Lake Titlow and rather have that water go into a retention pond. And third involves drain tile caps that will be discussed as well. It's my pleasure at this point to introduce Principal Jim Swanson of Sibley East High School and also a member of the Lake Titlow Beautification Committee.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I am Jim Swanson. I'm the chair of the Lake Titlow Committee, Cleanup Committee. I've been working on this for approximately 3 years now. I guess I'll try and speed this up as much as I can. You do have a number of handouts in front of you that I will discuss and leave a lot of it there for you to view at your leisure. Starting out with the very first handout, this gives you a little bit of a history of where we have been and our particular committee. We have been together now for approximately 3 years on a reorganizational basis. There have been a number of groups previous to us that have tried to work with lake cleanup, and because of the enormous efforts that are needed to clean that lake up and the watershed, a lot of them have kind of fallen by the wayside. We have been in existence for approximately 3 years now. When I took over as chair of the committee at that point, we decided to set up on a plan, first of all, to, number one, identify the issues. What is the problem with the lake, or the causes and effects? Number two, the second year we spent time going over how do we get it cleaned up and to correct those measures. And now the last year and a half, actually, we have been working with different agencies and so on to help in our efforts. And that is pretty much explained in that first handout. The number of things we have had, number four, I would like to read through that. Three and four, we have been working with a lot of agencies in our county, Pheasants Forever, Protection, Game Protection League, the state agencies, MPCA, DNR, and so on, to help in our efforts. And number four, we have had a real huge awareness of the problems in our community with the issues that are going on there, and this has really been stepped up to the plate by the citizens. Just 2 years ago, we have seen, or last 3 years ago, I should say, we had approximately 40 septic systems that were applied for permits to have them either done or redone. Most of those were in new housing. 2 years ago, we had 78 that were applied for, and now this current year, over this fall and winter, we have had over 108 permits have been applied for. So we can see just a big awareness where people have seen that was one of the areas that need to be cleaned up. The city is being very proactive in helping us on this, and they have been just a huge asset. In the last year, we've had a change in leadership there with the new mayor. The council members are really on board with us and helping us with our efforts. At this point, I'd like to move on to the handouts. You should have in front of you a brochure that our committee put together. And it's basically on our biggest concern here is educating the public on what needs to be done. We've created 5,000 of these for the community. We've been handing them out over the last year and a half to different groups when they get together, from the co-op dinners at the end of the year, to the fair, the county fair, to different organizations when they meet, just to bring awareness to the problem. The next handout you have is a picture of the watershed, and one of the issues we have is that it's one of the hugest watersheds in southern Minnesota. It's approximately 38 acres to 1 acre of lake. Most of the lakes are anywhere from 10 to 15. So we have a huge area that we are trying to work with. The next handout shows one of the problems we have, and that shows an open intake or open tile from a septic system going right into a road ditch directly from the septic tank. This particular one, you can see in the center of the picture there's a red post sticking up. That marks where the pipe comes into the ditch. And basically where it goes down in, see, maybe this works up here. You can see right up here, this is the post that even marks it. Well, this is completely illegal by the 7080 code of the state MPCA, but we find these all over the county. And I think you'll find them a lot throughout the state. Another issue we have are the feedlots. Just an example of the first part here shows basically the runoff from the feedlot going, again, right into a ditch. The top picture doesn't show it real well, but that's the wetlands up on the top side. And this, again, is probably within, I would say, probably 2 miles of our lake. Another issue we have is the practice of farming next to ditches that are created for water runoff, for tile systems and that from the land. And this shows an example of a not-so-good practice of farming right up to the ditches. In our county, we have some towing companies actually go out and pull combines and stuff right out of the ditch because they're trying to farm right almost into the ditch. So that is an issue we're trying to educate our public on. This is an example of what we are trying to get them to do, and that's to have set aside land next to the waterways that is a win-win situation for landowners. It stops erosion of the soil and also is habitat for pheasants and ducks and so on. This is a photo of one of the storm sewers coming from the city of Gaylord going right into the lake. We have 9 of those. And the city is being really proactive at this point of trying to address these. We're redoing our streets. We're on a kind of an orderly manner of getting that done. And this year, this is one of the items they'll be doing, or the next 3 years, there's a project to redo the streets. And along with that, with our project coming up now, they have really been proactive in saying we've got to do our part in keeping the stormwater from off our streets, off our lawns. The herbicides and so on, insecticides we're putting on our grass is going into the lake also on street runoff. And they're looking at diverting that water to holding ponds and rain gardens and this sort of thing. Another thing that they have done, or a problem we've run across, is the open intake tiles in fields. You can see in the center here, this is like a big manhole. This one is approximately 12 inches across. And basically they're set in the field. You'll see them when you drive, you know, down the countryside, the red flags marking out in the field different spots where the water goes in. Small tiles could fall into this. And again, when it get a heavy rain or the snow melt after like we've got now, that just flushes like a toilet right into the drains and goes into the ditches and then down to our lake and the Rush River area and then into the Minnesota River, to the Mississippi, to the dead zone we've got down in New Orleans. And sorry to say, but Sibley County, where this lake is located, is a huge contributor to that. To correct that problem, one of the things in the bill we're looking at is to be able to purchase these items. These are called risers or intake covers that will slow the water flow down so it holds more of the soil in place. The water can still get through, but it will slow it down so it isn't just a mad rush. One of the things that we have found out is that nutrients are carried by soil. They're not carried necessarily by the water. So the soil goes, so does the phosphorus, all the chemicals and so on too. Which will lead to the next slide. I am not, I'm not going to discuss this one a whole lot. I'm going to let that to another witness. That talks about the water flow coming into the lake the nutrients are being carried by that water, and it's a real huge problem that we have with that. The next thing I have, next handout is a kind of a cost summary or an estimation that you have in front of you of what the city is looking toward in improving the streets. The whole cost of the street project is about $4.7 million over a two-year period, and the cost of diverting the stormwater is a cost of approximately $800,000, and I'll just go on from there. The rest is pretty much on your handout. Again, the city needs to be commended on that. We really appreciate their efforts in really trying to help us out in this. And the last picture I have there is a map of the city of Gaylord along with the borders of the lake. And on that, there are some X marks along the shoreline that show where the intakes are coming in from the stormwater into the lake. There's a holding pond there that we're going to be using to divert that water and into the wetlands and so on. So that's in a nutshell what we're looking at doing.
And we have one additional testifier.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to introduce Dr. Trent Borlacek from Minnesota State University, Mankato.
Dr. Borlacek.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's a great honor to be here today and speak before you. Over the past 2 years, a colleague and myself in the Department of Chemistry and Geology at Minnesota State, in conjunction with a graduate student from the Department of Geography, have been looking at the water quality of Lake Titlow. And just to give you an idea, we have seven main sampling sites, which are shown as the red dots in this first handout that is given to you. Moving from left to right, just to give you an idea, from the three points on the left would be the major research or major recharge sites, sampling sites. And then we have three within the lake, and then finally one at the major outlet for the lake. One of the first things that we had to do, just logically speaking, was to determine where the water was coming from and where the water was going. And so you can see on the left we have a water balance, which is simply a balance of flow coming in and coming out. Flow is given to you for these various sites in cubic feet per second. And you can see these two right here, 13.2 and 5.5, represent two major ditches draining into the lake. And then if you add those two together, you get 18.7, and that roughly comes fairly close to the outlet, which is at 20.1. I should also note on this slide, in case you're wondering, there does appear to be a ditch at the top of the figure. That is a ditch, but it's a very minor contributor. And furthermore, the not available, that would be storm sewer from the city. And storm sewers are hit or miss for measuring flow because they're highly variable. One of the problems with Lake Titlow and the figure on the right certainly shows this are the sediment loads to and from the lake. Again, there are numbers in red and in blue. Basically, these are just two points in time. This is not continuous monitoring. These are discrete samplings. And so the red show for spring measurements, and the blue are for middle summer. And what we see here are, just to give you an idea, these are parts per million, which means milligrams of sediment per liter of water. And to give you a reference point, a typical southern Minnesota river has about 100 parts per million, or 100 milligrams per liter of sediment. A typical clear lake, take Lake Mille Lacs, for example, most people know that lake, would be about 1 to 3 parts per million. So you can see we have a large input here from one of the major, or the major, ditch. And the interesting thing to note, and it's not shown here, but I can explain it, if you take that concentration, 166 parts per million, multiplied by the flow rate of 13.2 cubic feet per second, converting your units, in case there's any students out there wondering how you can possibly multiply those two together, basically you come up with 5 tons of sediment on this one day into the lake. You have an output of 51, which multiplied by its flow gives about 2.5 tons leaving on this day, meaning half remains in the lake, have is discharge. Now, what's important to note here is that in the summer, where you have low flow conditions, you would expect your sediment loads to go to zero. And indeed, we see that. You can see the two dishes now zero and two. For all intents and purposes, zero input. In the lake, you have 60 parts per million. Again, a southern Minnesota river would have about 100 parts per million. What's concerning is you have shut off your valve, your input, and yet you are still outputting 24 parts per million of sediment. What's concerning about that is that affects downstream drainages, and of course, that contributes to total maximum daily loads. In a sense, the lake acts as, for lack of a better term, a source of sediment in the summer. Now, moving on to the next slide, nutrients. And again, we use the title snapshots. Again, these are moments in time. This is not continuous monitoring. Again, in the spring and in the middle summer. On the left, you see nitrate. Nitrate isn't so much of an issue for Lake Titlow. The EPA action level for nitrate is about 10 parts per million. You can see all the numbers listed there do not reach this value. However, the two things that I would like to note, one is you can see the lake, the values are zero, which as a chemist I should really say below detection. So why would that be? Well, you have such large inputs of nutrients for that algal blooms and whatnot, primary productivity takes up the nitrate as soon as it's added to the water. So in a sense, nitrate would be a limiting reagent. The other thing I'd like to note is that you can see in the summer the blue numbers for your inputs. You can see that the city, we do have a measurement here, 1.3 parts per million, again, milligrams per liter of nitrate in this case. The city contributes more than the two ditches as far as just in terms of concentration. Moving on to phosphate. Now, this one is a real concern. Now, let's just put things into perspective. For a lake to be considered eutrophic, that nominally means that the lake has, at a minimum, 100 parts per billion phosphorus, or 0.1 parts per million phosphorus. A lake like Lake Mille Lacs, a clear lake, would be expected to have about 0.01 parts per million, or 10 parts per billion. You can see every single one of these numbers, it doesn't matter when we measure it, phosphorus is either at or well above that number. In fact, in the summer, they are shocking. These are determined using a colorimetric whatever analysis, and it turns the solution blue. And I'll tell you what, when you run 2 parts per million, it's like a breathtaking blue. You almost have to have Kleenexes in your hand to wipe the tears away. But more importantly than that, let me just, again, put things into perspective for you. You see over here on the outlet, you have 0.7 parts per million phosphorus, total phosphorus. We have flow data for that. And so we can determine the total phosphorus output on this one single day. And if you do that, you find there are 36 pounds of total phosphorus for this day, May 17th, that has been discharged from the lake. To put that into proper perspective, the wastewater treatment plant of Gaylord, which is a town of 2,000 people, discharges monthly, on average, 24 pounds of phosphorus. So we're a third more of the monthly discharge in one day. Again, this is not continuous monitoring. This is just a snapshot.
You have one more slide?
Yes, one more slide, and I am the new folk. And this just gets to the overall theme here. Look, ideally, you would have both submergent and emergent vegetation. You'd have limited sedimentation. That is not the case with Lake Titlow. You go to Lake Titlow, it looks brown. Because it looks brown, it has high sediment suspended. Because it has high suspended sediments, there's low UV penetration, there is low emergent plant life, there is low diversity of plants or animals. The only fish you can catch are carp. Carp would be a problem because they add to the turbation of the system, which adds to the sediment and phosphorus that gets flushed down, which is currently not being accounted for, and something that you need to take into account for total maximum daily loads in the future.
Well, it's been a great education, a very quick education to the issue. And if the author has any concluding
comments. Thank you, Madam Chair. I think the two testifiers have covered it very well. We're concerned. We have three items on the proposed bill, and the concern is not only for Lake Titmo and for Gaylord, but that this watershed runs right down into the Minnesota River, and we're worried about the downstream concerns as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for bringing the issue before us. All of our bills are laid over for possible inclusion, and so we thank you for coming
in
this weather.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Slocum. Representative Hansen, would you want to move the...
Madam Chair, I would move the minutes from the February 27th.
Any discussion?
I'll move the bill.
I'll get back to you for that. Since you moved the minutes, discussion of the minutes. Not all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed, motion carries. Minutes are approved. And now
I will move the bill, House File 875.
Representative Slocum, welcome to the committee.
Thank you. This is my first bill. So be kind, or at least be funny.
Well, mostly be fast.
We're going to work on that. We're definitely going to be within the realm of the real here.
Great.
This is a pretty straightforward bill, House File 875. Pretty straightforward bill. It requests $500,000 from bond proceeds so Hennepin County can do emergency stabilization for the buildings on the upper bluffs of Fort Snelling. These are important buildings. They're on the National Register of Historic Places. However, they're also one of the most endangered historic places in America. So it's pretty critical that if we are going to retain these buildings, that we do something now. This is a particularly intriguing bill for me because Hennepin County uses sentence to serve labor for the stabilization project, providing people with skills and training to help them re-enter the workforce successfully, and their success ratio is very strong, very good. So I'm going to let my experts, this is Patrick Conoy and Bob Hunter, wherever he went, he'll be back, to go through some slides for you quickly and show you what exactly we're talking about.
For members who've been on this committee before, we've actually had a chance to tour this, but we have a lot of new members on the committee who are hearing it for the first time. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. Patrick Conoy, Hennepin County. Thank you for having us today. You have a presentation in front of you. It's the same presentation we're going to use on the PowerPoint today. Fort Snelling Upper Post is owned by the State of Minnesota Department of Natural Resources. It contains 28 buildings. Got the Fort Snelling Golf Course and then the athletic fields. Both the golf course and the athletic fields are leased currently to the Minneapolis Park and Recreation Board. Total of 141 acres of land. The Fort Snelling has National Historic Landmark designation, National Register of Historic Places, and just this last year was named to the 11 most endangered historic places by the National Trust. Hennepin County became involved with this in 2005 when we were asked by the state of Minnesota to apply to the state for a base realignment and closure grant. Hennepin County has a governmental authority in this area. It's unincorporated Hennepin County, and it's because of the realignment at the 88th Readiness Command, which is going to be moving a portion of its activities to Fort McCoy, Wisconsin. We received the base realignment grant from the state of Minnesota, and it concentrated on two areas: dislocated worker planning and land utilization. Since that time, we've really gotten more involved with the area, and we've been looking at stabilization of the buildings. We developed a task force of interested parties, which included military personnel, historic preservationists, federal government, a wide variety of municipalities, and we held a number of meetings through 2005 and 2006 on the Fort Snelling Upper Post area. I want to show you a few slides of exterior building conditions. As you can see on the 57 Band Barracks building, you've got roof condition problems. You've got exterior problems. The quartermaster shop building is actually collapsed because of the roof is collapsed because of the weather related. And the 101 barracks, you can actually see the crumbling of the bricks. Chuck Liddy is our architect, who's also here today, and he can comment more on detail if you want on the exterior and interior. Here are some interior shots. You can see the buildings have been rapidly deteriorating over the last years. These are four shots of four different buildings, and the buildings are really just collapsing within themselves. What we've been doing is we started working with our Sends2Serve, and Bob Hunter is here from Sends2Serve, using Sends2Serve crews through Hennepin County to seal the windows and do plywood work just last year. And then we worked in conjunction with the state DNR, where the DNR put in $20,000 for materials and equipment, and we brought in $20,000 for Sends2Serve crews, and we stabilized two buildings with roofs and additional plywood work. And that also trained Sends2Serve crews in this activity. What's really interesting about this is we're not only trying to stabilize buildings at Fort Snelling, but use this opportunity to train people coming out of the correctional system in these skills. Last year, we applied to the National Park Service, U.S. National Park Service, and we received a grant called Save America Treasures. This is a very competitive grant, and we found we were able to obtain the money if we accepted a lower amount. We actually applied for over $500,000, but we received a $150,000 grant. It requires a $150,000 match, and the grant would allow us to continue to use the STS crews to conduct weatherization activities on additional buildings. But that, even with the match, it will not cover all the needs that we want to do in 2007. Last year, we toured a number of ports around the country, Fort Sheridan in Chicago, but a number on the West Coast. And I've got a few examples here. This first one is in Fort Warden, Washington, which is northwest of Seattle. This is a fort that's owned by the state of Washington. This is actually where they filmed Officer and a Gentleman. But the state of Washington has owned this fort continuously and used the buildings. What they've done is they turned it into a meeting conference space. And they actually have accommodations where people can stay over and have a conference for large entities. They have a 280-seat theater. They have vacation homes and lodging and dormitories. And they put on conferences, workshops, performances, exhibitions, and festivals all through the year. It's really a marvelous site, and it's an example of what can be done in these forts if the buildings are kept up. The problem we have here is the buildings have been allowed to deteriorate, and the first step in that is stabilizing the buildings, so then you can move to the actual rehabilitation. The next one is Fort Vancouver, which is a cooperative effort between the City of Vancouver, Washington, the National Park Service, the State of Washington, and the U.S. Army, and that is what we are looking to move towards here, working closely with the State DNR, the National Park Service, and our State Historic Preservation Office. And they've got buildings in the Officers' Row, which are actually owned by the City of Vancouver. They've bonded for rehab costs. They have residences and office space, and they're paying that bond back through rents on these facilities. Through the bonding request before you today, we are asking to have that be used for $150,000 to match the Save America Treasures grant and use STS crews, which Bob has. In addition, we'd like to use $350,000 more to do other work that isn't specifically covered under the Save America Treasures grant, but is very much needed to continue the restoration and stabilization work. And what we'd like to do on that is use STS crews to the greatest extent possible. The STS crews were able to do two roofs this past year, but some of the buildings have slate roofs, which require a very specialized skill. So we'd like to be able to upgrade the training for the STS crews and do even more. Oops. So, Bob, I don't know if you want to say a word or two about Sends2Serve.
Madam Chair, committee members, I'm Bob Hunter with Hennepin County Community Corrections. I manage a number of community-based programs, one of which is this STS Homes, Sentencing to Service Homes program. It's a seven-month reentry initiative that's been operating for 7 years. We select men and women in the minimum security prisons. We employ a journey scale foreman through the Carpenters Union to be our foreman, pick up our crews at various prisons around Metro, and take them out to sites. Our primary work assignment is residential construction. We're doing homes all over the metro. But last summer, we had the opportunity to start working at Fort Snelling, looking for new opportunities all the time, but we were out there for several weeks last fall, and it turned out to be an excellent training program, high level, really advanced type of skills training. So we're looking forward to getting back out. It's been a good program. Like Patrick was saying, there were two buildings with the roofs were holes in the roofs and the trusses were pretty much rotted away. So we went up, took the equipment off, or took the materials off, fixed the rot, and refinished them out. We also, several buildings out there, we put ventilation and plywood on the windows. So it's a real good opportunity for our crews, and it's just a worthwhile place for us to be.
Right. This image shows two of the buildings that were worked on. I believe the gymnasium building had a hole in the roof right in the front, and then the headquarters building. And you can see the new plywood. If you drive out towards the airport now and you look at the buildings, you see the new plywood on all the buildings. That is the plywood that Bob's crews put on, all that plywood. And the roofs are the next step.
Thanks for that build presentation. You're, at this point, simply about stabilization of the resource.
Correct, yeah.
And Representative House.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You, Madam Chair, you've been on Capital Investment Committee for during Prinke's 10 years, Chairman?
Yes.
Do you recall visiting this site?
I do.
Because I believe at that time, and I could be wrong, I was wrong once before, that this land and these buildings are actually owned by the federal government, but managed and overseen by the DNR. I don't believe we own them.
I have Larry Peterson's here from the State Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Peterson?
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself.
I'm Larry Peterson. I'm the Development and Acquisition Manager for State Parks at the DNR. Madam Chair, committee members, the land at Fort Snelling in 1971 was deeded to the state of Minnesota to be under the custodial control of the DNR. However, the deed has a number of covenants and restrictions in it so that nothing can really be done without the federal government's approval, specifically the National Park Service's approval.
Representative House.
Madam Chair, I think this committee needs to take some time at some point and decide what we want to do with these buildings. I mean, if we're going to spend $500,000 to seal them up and not do anything with them, and they just sit there for another 20 years, we might as well throw $500,000 into the river. Why don't we look at what the cost would be to really revitalize them, make them worth something, and if we're overcrowded at the vet's hospital or the veterans home, let's incorporate that into the vet's home and utilize it. Let's use it for something useful and substantial rather than continuing to put plywood on the windows and let it rot away. It's just we're not accomplishing anything. But then the question needs to be begged. If we do that, fix them up and make them look like some in the back of the information they handed out, how do we know that the federal government might say, boy, they look really good. I think we're going to move some of our troops and officers there.
If there's an interest, members, a small group of this committee could perhaps spend a little bit of time in conversation about that. That probably would involve consulting with a few other staff. Representative Dean? Oh, Representative Carlson, I'm sorry, and then Representative Dean.
Madam Chair, I have a question. When was the last year? This is a general question. Second question, I know stabilizing is one issue, and third, sitting here thinking about security issues, analyzing a couple of pictures that look like there's not much left to vandalize, security as well as the last use.
I believe the gentleman from the DNR is going to answer that one.
Madam Chair, Representative Larry Peterson, security is better than it used to be. We've fenced off the front of the Area J site so that it's harder to get behind the buildings. There has been a little bit of vandalism on the back of one of the buildings over the last couple of years that we've now, I think, removed and repaired. It has not been, vandalism on the building exteriors has not been a big problem. The work that Hennepin County STS has been doing to seal up all the windows and the doors and the holes has been invaluable in terms of preventing intrusion into the interior of the buildings. So I think we're making pretty good headway on that. As far as the last occupancy, it varies by building. The hospital, I believe, went out of service in 1969. Various buildings were used through the 70s and 80s. About 91 or 92 was the last building that was in use when that closed.
Representative B.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just had a question. We're on the site last year in the bonding tour, and I'm wondering if there's any overlap between the projects that were proposed by the Minnesota Historical Society and these projects.
Any overlap?
Madam
Mr.
Chair,
Kanoi?
I do not believe, Patrick Kanoi, Hennepin County, I do not believe there's overlap. We're talking about the upper post exclusively here, and I think the other project was on the other side.
Madam Chair, I was just in just specifically about the historic designation, is this, how does the historic designation of this place as the historic landmark, it says up there that it's a historic place, what kinds of protections are on the individual buildings themselves within that designation, and do they vary from building to building? Because there's, just walking through, there's some buildings that look like they're of high architectural value, and there's others that look like they're of low architectural value to an untrained person. But are they protected equally?
Mr. Peterson.
Representative Dean, Madam Chair, it's a National Historic Landmark site that contains a great number of buildings. And you're absolutely correct. There are some that are probably less important than others. Any redevelopment or reuse proposal, as I understand it, would be considered on its own merits, and there are some buildings that would have to be preserved under all circumstances. There are other ancillary buildings in the back of the main area, J area, that might not need to be preserved. So that becomes a discussion with the State Historic Preservation Office and the National Park Service when there's a proposal put forward.
Madam Chair, I think if we're moving forward, it would probably make sense to have a survey of each of the buildings before we invested a great deal of money going forward beyond what you're talking about here.
Representative Mahoney.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and this is Mr. Peterson. I'm going to piggyback on my colleague's question here. What is the assurance to the state of Minnesota, if we chose to do something with these buildings, that the National Park Service, federal government, doesn't come in and override what we had intended to do once we'd invested the money? Is there any safeguard to the state?
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney. Up until about 2 years ago, there was a reverter clause in, or there still is a reverter clause in the existing deed that would allow the Department of Defense to take back any portion they need to. However, in anticipation of reuse and leasing of some or all of the property, the National Park Service worked with us about 2 years ago to get the Department of Defense to write a letter indicating they would release that reverter clause if the deed were rewritten, and we are poised to do that if a successful reuse proposal comes along. So the Department of Defense is on record that they would remove that reverter clause, and we believe that would provide some protection.
Representative Mahoney.
So which comes first, the chicken or the egg here? I mean, what do you got to do to... What do you have to do to get the Defense Department to say, okay, we'll sign on the dotted line? Do we have to invest $1 million or $2 first, or would they sign on the dotted line prior to the million, you know, the investment, whether it's $500,000 or $5 million? I don't know.
Mr. Peterson.
Madam Chair, Representative Mahoney,
They have indicated in correspondence that they would approve a rewriting of the deed that would not have a reverter clause in it, and we have written correspondence to that effect. The deed has not been rewritten because we don't have a reuse proposal that is being put forward.
There's a comment here, but it just gives you the trouble.
Representative Peterson, I'll save you from that.
Thank you.
I'm just make sure I understand. In the in this photo is where the gymnasium is up in the corner. This is the Highway 52-62 Crosstown merger. When you talk about the upper post, and then what we saw last year was the lower post that was over by... So at some point in time, when you start talking about this thing, you've got to get the two pieces put together, because that, as Representative Dean was talking, that application was $6 or $7 million to redo the officers' barracks that were on the lower post, and this is the upper. So this is, there's two big pieces to the puzzle here.
And I will tell you, members, anytime someone comes to my office on any project in that whole area, whether it's Historical Society or Hennepin County or the state or, I think Minneapolis has a role, I've always said, and the federal government, could they all sit down around a table and come forward with a plan for that entire area? One has the sense that with an LRT stop now, it could be an incredible destination, but it is sort of in this vast open area that's hard to access, and it's always been a desire to see all those entities simply get together around the table until they came to some conclusion. And I understand those discussions are taking place, but perhaps not as vigorously. Representative Peterson,
but Madam Chair, given the magnitude of the Fort Snelling piece, which is the lower, and the Hennepin County piece. Again, it begs to say that spending $500,000 to allow this thing to be stabilized till that happens is probably a stewardship thing we're going to have to do. Even though it's big, somehow we have a stewardship responsibility.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You almost answered my question. How close is this to the light rail or a light rail stop?
Mr. Kanoy.
Madam Chair, Patrick Kanoy. It's about... Three to four blocks. It's a little bit longer than what you would normally consider under a transit or development project, but it's within walking distance.
Representative Tinglestad.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm just curious about any liability issues, if there's some people that were to get into the buildings and injuries. Is there certain things needed for insurance purposes to bring it up to a minimal amount? Maybe that's Mr. Peterson.
Mr. Peterson?
Representative Tinglestad, Madam Chair. Again, I'm not an attorney, so I can't really address liability in a very legal sense, but we've been working very hard to fence off areas where people could drive or get behind the buildings. We've been working very hard to seal all the windows and all the doors and all the openings so that people cannot get into the buildings, and we feel that's best management practice and hard to do much more than that in terms of preventing intrusion. What the work that is being proposed here is largely mothballing to prevent weather damage and further deterioration of the buildings so that the roofs don't fall in and we lose the whole building. We've already lost one building out there.
Okay, thank you.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Mr. Peterson, this is probably off the picture a little bit, but you also had some barns that were part of the Historical Society. What happened to the barns? What's the use of them? The stables?
That I believe, was part of the Historical Society presentation to us. That's in the area where they are suggesting that the new visitor center goes. Is that correct, Mr. Peterson?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, that's correct. That would be the lower post or the MHS site, not the upper post.
Okay, thanks. Madam Chair, just one other question. Has anybody had any conversation, and this goes back quite a few years, with the airport authority? Because there was some interest at one time, because the airport's right there, MAC is right there, to have them have some of the use of some of the land.
Mr. Peterson, are you able to?
Yes, I am able to speak to that, Madam Chair, Representative Solberg. We have met at least twice with the Metropolitan Airports Commission, and they have not expressed interest in the upper post site. We also have met with the Transportation Security Agency. They have toured the site on at least one occasion, probably two occasions, and have not followed up with further interest for using the site.
And Representative House, did you have an additional question?
Well, yeah, Madam Chair, I'm and Representative Slocum. I was born and raised about a mile from there, so I kind of know that whole area. And actually, I remember driving down that road when those buildings were still in use. So they're old buildings. Thank you, Representative Junkie. But
were there horses there too?
Yes, there were. That's where actually we had to move Whiskey's grave because of the crosstown.
There you go.
See, so but I would love to see these buildings actually refurbished and put to a use, whatever that use might be. I don't know, but I'm very hesitant to spend more money on a piece of property that will just sit there, and yet we do not have ownership of it. We only have what we have is the responsibility of just taking care of it. So what I would like at least for the committee to do, and I know we're just laying it over for further consideration, but I would like if the chair could request the DNR or admin or whoever is responsible for that area to nail down with the federal government and the Defense Department and get this deed and all these clauses out of there so we either have it or we don't have it. And then I would love if we, every bonding cycle, refurbish one of those buildings and make that a goal. Let's use them for something and let's make a use of it instead of dropping $500,000 in there. That just goes away, and there's no benefit.
And Madam Chair,
Representative Slocum, the concluding comment.
Well, hopefully, they will be. Yes. And Representative House, if we don't stabilize these buildings, the opportunity to historically restore them to their former glory will be gone, or will it goes up in price if it isn't. I mean, if you're allowing a building to have the roof cave in and the bricks fall down, it becomes more and more and more expensive to rehab. And because of their historical designation, there are certain stipulations that come with that, too. So I think it's critical. Well, I think this bill does two really good things. First, it stabilizes so we have the option of restoring. And secondly, it employs people and gives them some job skills who wouldn't normally maybe get those job skills. So you're doing two good things with this bill.
Well, you've made the case well. We obviously have questions, and maybe we'll have some conversation about whether a small group wants to do some conversation around this. But we thank you very much for bringing
it. And if anyone has any other questions, Madam Chair, I can get you in contact with my experts.
Thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you.
Members, the House Call 858, we're going to put at the end of the agenda. Her testifier wasn't able to come, and so we may have her come down, depending on how quickly we move through the remainder. So, Representative Markwart, if we could ask you to come forward. And, Representative Leader, would you?
I'll move the House file. I've forgotten the number.
Oh.
I can play them on this one, but evidently I'm skipping that one.
883.
883, Madam Chair.
The leader moves House File 883. Representative Markwart, welcome to the committee, and make your case for the bill.
Well, thank you very much, Madam Chair, and Representative Leader, for moving that. And Representative Howells is talking about throwing money into a river. I'd ask you to throw money into river management on this bill, if you would. But this really goes back to 1997, when up and down the Red River Valley, we were hit with a devastating flood, and you're all very much aware of it with the amount of money that went into flood mitigation projects in East Grand Forks and Breckenridge and others. There were other communities that were affected. Representative Lanning and myself were mayors of two towns that were, of course, located very close to the Red River Valley. The total cost of the 1997 flood in disaster expenses was about $3.7 billion. And so what House File 883 does, it puts together a partnership of federal, state, and local units of government to come together and provide a valuable tool for helping prevent future flood damages. And what we're requesting from the state in this bill would be $600,000 of a total cost of about $5 million. There's other partners, $2.5 million would be federal government. Now, what this does, it would allow for, and I've got experts here going to get into more details on this, a very detailed digital elevation mapping of the Red River Basin. What would be some of its benefits? It would improve disaster preparedness, would allow for the evaluation and planning of flood mitigation projects and also preventing future flood damage. Also, Representative Junkie would be, and he knows much more than I do on this, many agricultural groups are very supportive of this because it would help very much in precision agriculture and looking at soil mapping, erosion, ditch control, all those type of things that farmers could use to help lower their production costs. So not only does it have huge benefits as far as potentially reducing costs for flood damage, but also for the agricultural area. I do have to mention one thing, Madam Chair, and Mr. Harnick just brought this to my attention, is that since this isn't part of an actual planning, design, and construction of a project, that it may not be bondable. It's a kind of a freestanding. So they were talking with Senator Langseth's office and so forth, who's the co-author of the bill or the author of the bill in the Senate. So that's something we probably may have to iron out yet. I just wanted to be upfront with that, Madam Chair.
Cash would work, but not bonding.
That's correct. And so at this time, I would like to turn it over to the experts here, and I don't know who will go first, but we have Mr. Ron Harnick, who is the project coordinator from the Red River Water Management Board, and Mr. John Rochlin, who is the district administrator for the Bois de Soux Watershed District. And are you going to start, John?
Rochlin?
Rochlin. Thank you very much.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
My name is John Rochlin. I'm the
Rochlin,
yes. I'm the administrator of the Bois de Soux Watershed District. I'm here taking Mr. Charles Fritz's place. He's snowed in Fargo right now. I happen to be down here for the Minnesota State Wrestling Tournament. So, my son is the heavyweight, go Bullets. in Wheaton. The digital elevation model program that we're trying to do, basically this initiative has about four main objectives. I'm going to paraphrase what Mr. Fritz put together for his testimony today. And those four points, number one is to develop a seamless bare earth digital elevation model with 15 centimeter, which is approximately 6 inches vertical, and 1 meter or approximately 3 foot horizontal accuracy for the entire U.S. portion of the Red River Valley. This is Minnesota, North Dakota, South Dakota area. Number two, it provides for the collection of high-resolution imagery over a selected area, or many selected areas of the Red River Basin. Number three, the development of a public web-based data archival and dissemination system, meaning that it'll be available to the public for use for many different reasons. And number four, provides for public outreach. Our current digital elevation information consists of 10 to 30 meter models, which this particular model would be a lot more precise. We're talking 6 inches here vertical as opposed to 10 to 30 meters. And it comes from the existing USGS topography mapping system, and many of which date back to the 1950s. So what we're using now to develop our flood damage reduction projects, of which I'm involved in one major one, is very old data. Technology is available now and becoming affordable to be much more precise, be much more efficient in develop and design of these projects, and as well as determine the areas that will benefit from these projects, and help us to select the best locations for these projects. Recently, over the past 4 months, this project or program has gathered quite a bit of momentum. Mr. Fritz has over $680,000 committed to this project locally through the cities of Fargo, Moorhead, and Breckenridge, through the watershed districts within the Red River Valley, including the Buffalo Red and the other member watershed districts of the Red River Watershed Management Board. So the interest locally is great, and we're working with the state of North Dakota as well to collect a commitment from them for a share of this, similar to what we're asking for here.
Thank you. Madam Chair, if I could have Mr. Harnack go
Welcome
next.
To the committee, Mr. Harnack.
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, my name is Ron Harnack, Project Coordinator for the Red River Watershed Management Board. Thank you for the opportunity to testify on this. I want to thank Representative Marquardt for carrying this bill. We think this opportunity that we have here with leveraging state, federal, and local dollars is a great opportunity to take advantage of that partnership and achieve a real need for the Red River Valley. Most of you been up in the Red River Valley and know you come off the uplands and it drops down into old Glacial Lake Agassiz, where it's very, very flat. And as you try to hydrologically model that area with topography that is 2, 3, 5 feet elevation data, you can't do a very good job. As we all saw in 1997, when the water came up so quickly twice, it just flowed straight across the landscape. It couldn't even get to the river. And how do you begin to be able to model that and to be able to assess what are the opportunities to implement flood damage reduction on a comprehensive basis throughout the basin? It's darn difficult. This elevation data, plus minus 6 inches, less than 6 inches, will give us the opportunity to have a seamless set of information that goes not only to the Canadian border, but Manitoba has already completed this as an outgrowth of the demands from 1997 flood. For us to be able to be in concert with them in being able to hydrologically model the basin, determine how we can collectively reduce flooding throughout the basin, this elevation is really important. A second element is you take the communities that are already flooded, and this data will allow us to be able to map out every house, every farmstead in the basin, and be able to anticipate when the floods are coming, and be able to identify within a public information network, if you need sandbags to protect yourselves, how many you're going to need. Here's where you can get them. And so the whole flood warning preparedness and implementation will be a significant enhancement as well for the area. Development of projects, having this additional information, will reduce the long-term costs. We're going to gather this information one way, shape, or form. We're either going to do it incrementally, project by project, which is a much, much higher cost, or we can do it in partnership with the rest, a seamless model, seamless data for the entire Red River Valley. We can do it at a much, much more cost-effective way and means. The other ancillary benefits to transportation, you look at culvert replacements, you look at road construction, this information is going to be invaluable for transportation system infrastructure design planning as well. Precision agriculture. One of the individuals who was going to be here to testify as well operates a precision agriculture company out of Alexandria. And they work in 9 states, do a lot of work with agriculture in Minnesota and North Dakota. And they find that we can go a long ways to making agricultural production more efficient, more profitable, and at the same time, we can significantly reduce fertilizer costs,
as well as the contribution of phosphorus and sedimentation losses throughout the basin. So we've got a broad array of benefits that we think this can bring to the table, and we believe this is a unique opportunity with state, local, and federal money. We did spend a few weeks ago, spent 3 days in Washington talking with Minnesota's congressional delegation, Senator Klobuchar, Senator Coleman, Congressman Peterson, as well as the congressional delegation from North Dakota. And although we anticipate dollars to be very, very tight, I was optimistic that they might be found a way to be able to bring this their share of the money home. One question that comes up is this have endorsement of the Minnesota Governor's Council on Geographic Information? And it does. There is a letter in your packet which reflects that. It was actually sent to Congressman Peterson's office on it, and Tim Lesh from that office is here if you have specific questions on that component. You can see the other support that's coming other than the basic financial contributors. You got the Red River Sugar Beet Growers Association, Minnesota Wheat Growers, Precision Partners, which works with Precision Agriculture, Greenway on the Red, the International Red River Board, Red River Basin Commission, and then in North Dakota we have similar organizations that are also supporting this. So appreciate the opportunity and time, Madam Chair, and we'll try to answer any questions to the best of our ability.
And just to this, in a sort of a related issue, Representative Singleset, if you just want to mention to members about the overview.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This whole issue of digital mapping is one of the fastest moving things kind of in technology these days. And I know through the LCCMR we had several proposals this fall that touched on this issue. And in fact, the LCCMR is having a presentation next Friday. I know it was announced in the Environment Committee, and it's open to any legislators who might be interested. So next Friday, March 9th, from 2 to 4, I'm not sure which meeting room, but here in the state office building, we'll have some people from the Governor's Council on Geographic Information, and then a couple other presenters, because besides the LIDAR, there's a couple other ones that are sort of moving quickly as well, and there's some way to augment them. And I know one of the hearing presentations we had this fall noted that with the flyover that's needed to do this type of work, there's a way to do it sometimes where you can package a couple of projects at once so that you're only paying for the pilot once, but several different groups are participating in it. So there are some economies of scale in the various options of it.
So we thank you for bringing the background to us. And do you have any concluding comments to the Representative Marquardt?
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for those comments, Representative Dingell said, because if you could do it statewide, would probably be the best type of thing to do. But thank you for those comments, and thanks for your
I think we have one question, Representative Soltz.
Madam Chair, just very quickly, on this page, the X's have committed.
Yeah.
Is that correct? And the federal government is pending?
Mr.
Chair, Senator Representative Colbert, yes, that's correct.
And my question is one of timing. Do you expect the federal government to be here in October, November, December? When?
Madam Chair, Representative Colbert, when we talk with Congressman Peterson's office, we anticipate that at least some of the budget stuff will be beginning to move forward the end of March. When it gets done, I guess I wouldn't even want to guess.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Representative Erdahl, you have a testifier on House File 866, but not on the other one. Is that correct?
That's right.
If you're okay with this, we would take House File 866, and then because Representative Portman has somebody testifying, we would do that, and then we'd revert to your other if we get both, just to take advantage of all the people who've managed to come in. Representative Peterson?
I was going to ask Representative Erdahl, if he does that, would he be willing to look at a per diem amendment? I think not.
I think he declined to yield. Representative Erdahl moves House File 866.
Thank you, Madam Chair, committee members, and if you're good to me today, I won't bring forth any per diem amendments.
Do you have someone that you want to have join you at the table?
Barry Glinke. This bill, and mainly I'll let Mr. Glinke, the engineer, explain it to you, deals with the city of Howard Lake in a problem that they have with a silted over culvert, creating a flooding problem for the city. And if they get the silt cleared out, it becomes another problem on the other side of the railroad. So I will let the engineer introduce himself and explain in more detail what the problem is.
Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Barry Glinke, consulting city engineer for the city of Howard Lake.
City of what?
City of Howard Lake, excuse me. I believe you should have got a couple handouts with a couple aerial photographer photographs on there for review.
Yeah,
We do have. I think we all have the two. If you,
it may be easier to point.
Okay.
He knows what he's doing.
Yeah. What we have here in figure number one is a large aerial of the area to be looked at. The city of Howard Lake is in this area here. Area outlined by the black line over here is the area of the flooding concerns that we have. This area in here is a recently constructed industrial park that currently is in the city limits. The area of the wetlands is outside of the city limits in the township on property owned by the DNR. If we go to figure two, we'll get a little closer to what we need to look at. You can see this is a little zoom in on where we were on the first figure, concentrating on the area we're looking at. Again, this is the flood flown area down here. What has caused this is a siltation of a railroad culvert along with the siltation of the wetland currently over here. You can see the pool area here, which is some open water area, where the culvert is in this area that has silted in on the downstream side of that, causing that not to work effectively and not moving the water through the drainage area as well as it should, causing flooding back upstream in the industrial park and also some industrial or property owners in the city of Howard Lake. Excuse me. The plan of action, what needs to be done in working with the railroad, MnDOT, and the DNR, both DNR and DNR Fisheries, is kind of laid out on this sketch as well. It consists of a clean out of the ditch here. Currently, the intake of this culvert is submerged. It's a 4-foot culvert. It's submerged by silts by about 3 feet. So if you can envision that, we got about 7 feet of silt there. That's hampering the drainage. With that, we need to clean out this wetland to open up that drainage into the permanent water pool and then construct a ditch out of that pool down into this area. The DNR Fisheries was involved in this kind of layout due to the fact that this is a hatchery that they are obviously concerned about. This is a hatchery for Howard Lake. This channel layout is what they envision to slow the water down to not get water through their hatchery so fast as to hamper the effectiveness of the hatchery. Over the past two years, spring of 06, spring of 05, during the spring melts and the spring rains, this building here, has been completely surrounded by water as the wetland backs up and doesn't and doesn't drain out. Also, the highway in this area, when it was constructed at an elevation such that the wetland did not affect the roadbed of the highway. And now with the elevated wetland elevation of about 3 feet, it's saturated the roadbed, and during the spring becomes a real rough ride in there. All the joints are cupped, and it's very noticeable as the frost comes out. So it's also causing some damage there on MnDOT's side of things. This lays out a little bit of what needs to be done. Part of the project would also consist of a permanent erosion control in this area, some establishment of some riprap, and also some buffer strips along some tilled areas in here and also over here to help reduce the amount of runoff that we receive in this drainage area. And then again, the clean out of the pond or the clean out of the pool to facilitate the railroad culvert and the construction of the ditch. I have received commitment from the railroad to install a new culvert once the drainage issues are taken care of. Currently, that culvert that's in there now dates back about 150 years, so it is time for replacement on their behalf. But they've committed to replace that once things are taken care of and at the proper elevation.
Professor Solberg has a question.
Have you had a conversation with the MnDOT about, obviously, if we do this, there's a benefit to the road? Are they participating in some of your costs?
Madam Chair.
Mr. Blinky?
Yes. We've discussed it with MnDOT. They do not have a whole lot of funds for off-site improvements off their right-of-way. That's why they kind of sent us in this path to pursue some funds. They would really enjoy it or appreciate it if we got the water situation taken care of, but they have not committed any such funds.
Madam Chair, it seems to me, though, that they would be a benefit from this. And it seems to me that they may not have a lot of funds, but they don't have a lot of funds for a lot of things. But if it's stabilizing their roadbed, would be a big cost savings in the long run for them. And then I just have one other question for you as well. It looks like you have a farm close by, right there.
Mm-hmm.
The ownership of that, is that a private individual?
That is private.
Mr. Clinton.
Excuse me. Madam Chair, yes, that's privately owned by this resident.
And Madam Chair, do they get flooded at all?
Mr. Clinton.
Madam Chair, yes, they do. The water does encroach upon this homestead that's right here, up towards that homestead, and they are one of the vocal public that has called the city and the township both to address the problem.
Madam Chair, just one more thing. Then on the last part of the fishery part, where does the water come at the present time for the fishing pond or growing pond, whatever you call it?
Mr. Planky.
Madam Chair. Currently it does follow the same drainage path at a highly reduced rate. That's why the fishery is such a nice thing there, because there is hardly any water flow there, which starts backing up water the whole way up the watershed.
Representative Lanning.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Is there an organized watershed in this particular sub-watershed?
Mr. Glinke.
Madam Chair, Lanning. No, there is not. It's not an identified watershed other than the Howard Lake, and the Wright County Soil and Water District has some control over it, which they've been involved in the planning of this too as well.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I think this helps illustrate something I've worked on, and I'm working on some legislation right now, in fact, to find a way to encourage more sub-watersheds to get organized. They have capacity in a Minnesota law to levy some taxes that could help do projects like this, and this is a good example of that. The other question I would have is, does this project have a positive impact on water quality for the lake?
Mr. Clinkie.
Madam Chair, yes, it would. It would provide some additional treatment to the drainage water prior to entering the Howard Lake. fishery area. By that, by the expansion of that water pool, helps slow the water down to treat that water prior to it, prior to the entrance into the Howard Lake.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I would just say that it seems to me that Clean Water Legacy Funds, which we hope we can expand significantly this session, seems to me that these kinds of projects are projects then that ought to be eligible for that funding to help improve our impaired water. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. And Representative Erdahl, do you have any concluding comments?
Just, Madam Chairman, just very briefly, I would add that Representative Junkie regularly drives this road. We do want it to be safe for him. And so this road, this bill is good for water quality. It's good for the environment. It's good for the town of Howard Lake. It's good for Representative Junkie. And appreciate your consideration.
Thank you very much. Representative Hortman.
Do we like Representative Junkie?
Yeah, I mean. Oh, we don't want him to be safe.
Lynn.
We'll take a vote on that.
Representative Carlson?
Yes, I'd like to
Welcome to the committee, Representative Portman, and please address the issue of House File 1026.
This is a project that was brought to my attention by residents of the community in this area. If you look at the MapQuest map that you have, I think you're all probably familiar with the MapQuest maps. I have a handout. It's a two-sided thing. One side is very difficult to read, and the readable side is the MapQuest side. And what I did is I circled the area where this trail will be. This is near the Springbrook Nature Center, and you have a separate bonding request from the City of Fridley on the Springbrook Nature Center, and that's bonding for construction of buildings, is my understanding, and it doesn't relate to trails at all. The City of Fridley...
It just occurred to me, you had to delete everything.
I do.
Right? And so... Representative Carlson moves A070147. It's a delete all, so we should be talking about that.
0157.
What is it?
You said 4710157.
157.
Yeah.
Okay. All in favor of that amendment?
Aye.
Those opposed? Motion carries, and that is the bill now before us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. The portion of the map that is indicated where it says Fridley Trail. The City of Fridley applied for federal funds in the year 2001 to construct a bicycle and pedestrian trail from University Avenue to just past the railroad tracks. And they have been approved and will be getting the money and building that trail this summer. University Avenue, which is on the right-hand side of this trail, and East River Road, which is on the left-hand side of this trail, are both major metro transit routes. There's a great deal of bus service in both of those corridors. Also, along 85th Avenue, there's a lot of bus service. There are bus stops there. There's no shoulder on 85th Avenue. There's no sidewalk. Northtown Mall is a major transit hub. It's a park and ride that has routes going straight into Minneapolis and straight into St. Paul. And then along the Mississippi River, there is a bike trail that already exists. After the City of Fridley builds their 4,200-foot trail this summer, there will be 1,500 feet with no trail and no shoulder. And this is the piece that the residents of this community would really like to see get finished. Just to the north of 85th Avenue, there are senior townhomes. And right near that star is a Panera and a used bookshop. And there's many, many families and children in this area also. And so right now it is not a safe place for people to be walking down the side of the road. But 85th Avenue has a lot of bicycle and pedestrian traffic. They're just on the road. I would like to offer one more amendment, if I can, to my bill. And that is in the caption at line 1.3, changing the word Anoka County to the City of Coon Rapids.
Representative Carlson moves that amendment in the title of the City of Coon Rapids. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? That motion carries, and we have made that change.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And the reason why that's important is I know that the counties work together with Metropolitan Council, and there's a whole park and trail system of people not trying to jump in line, but I just want to be absolutely clear that this project was brought to me by the residents in this area. The City of Coon Rapids has been very cooperative, and their city engineer has looked at completing that trail in that area. And I have with me today the city manager for the City of Coon Rapids, Matt Fulton.
Mr. Fulton, do you have additional comments? Representative Murphy, did you have a question?
I did have a question about the... Mr. Chairman and Representative Reutemann, I thought you said that it's just a small connection. And how much of a connection was that?
It's about 1,500 feet, Madam Chair, Representative Murphy. The complicating factor in this area is that the water table is very high, and so there would have to, instead of just laying, the reason why this isn't even been on the radar screen in the City of Coon Rapids to do this project anytime soon is because you can't just put piles of dirt there and then put a sidewalk on top or put a sidewalk on top of existing dirt. Right now there's a deep ditch there that's filled with cattails and water. And so there would have to be a drainage pipe underneath, and would also what it would do is it would drain the water towards the railroad bed.
Representative Murphy.
And Madam Chair, so it's the drainage pipe that makes it cost so much?
Representative Hartman.
Madam Chair, Representative Murphy, that is the biggest cost driver. The portion that the City of Fridley is completing is all elevated boardwalk, and that's how they're dealing with the water problem, which is also a more expensive way of constructing a trail. That's why for about 20 years, the City of Fridley and Anoka County and the City of Coon Rapids have wanted to do a trail here, but they've kind of been throwing up their hands and saying this is too difficult. But since Fridley has obtained $1 million in federal funding, seems like a good time for us to complete this trail because it connects so many transit corridors.
Mr. Fulton, welcome to the committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Committee members, thank you for letting me be here today. I think Representative Hartman really represented it very well. It's a very expensive section of trail. Trail's only as good as far as it can get you from one spot to the next. And City of Coon Rapids funds about $70,000 for trail enhancements, improvements every year in their annual budget. This is clearly a much more expensive project to accomplish, but it's an important one because it's along a major east-west corridor. From a trails perspective, east-west is a difficult way to get around town on trails. As you can see on the map that was provided to you, it provides a very good connection to East River Road and one of our city parks that will also then get you down into the Mississippi River where there's already a very successful trail system already in place. So this, in our opinion, is advancing the opportunity to make some trail connections in our community on a very significant county east-west road.
I think we have Representative Junkie and then Representative Virginius.
Madam Chair and Representative Hartman, your witness, I think you mentioned something about Anoka County. Do they have a comprehensive trail plan for this area you're talking about, and is this piece a part of that comprehensive trail plan?
Mr.
Madam Chair, committee members, it is not part of the region. It's not part of the county's trail system. The trail system by Anoka County is further to the south, and I can't really respond accurately or objectively on the status of where they are. From a user standpoint, I can tell you that it's a very difficult thing to come east-west to connect into the Anoka system down along the river. This is really taking it, really recognizing the traffic loads that 85th Avenue handles, the residences, and particularly the older residents that live adjacent to this, and a connection east-west from Northtown all the way over to East River Road.
And Madam Chair, the reason I ask is I'll be asking that on a lot of trail projects as we go forward, and I've learned in my area, I have so many people coming forward for trails, and I'm not arguing the merit of this. It's very good and probably very well needed, but what I've instructed my county to do was to work with DNR and come forward with a comprehensive trail plan for the county and for the area, so that we're not piecemealing here, 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 and here, but rather we are going in a definite direction. I know there's a lot of counties and areas that have not done that, and I think that's probably the first wise thing they could do. It costs nothing for them to do it other than time. DNR is willing to go out, and they have personnel to do that. So it's a question I'll be asking of a lot of folks when they come through on trails. So we understand as a committee, I think, whether we're a piece of that or not.
And your concern is connectivity.
Yes.
Representative Wagenius.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I understand you're talking about older folks here is one, but would this piecing together these trails provide opportunities for folks to commute by trail?
Representative Portman.
Absolutely. That's the thing that makes this, I don't believe it's on anybody's comprehensive trail plan. And this is sort of a different thing than a recreational trail. This really would allow people to get to the bus stops and to the park and ride at Northtown. And it's there's just not a safe way to take your bike anywhere in Coon Rapids down across this way to Northtown Mall and to get on transit. And there's a great program for the city of Minneapolis that Congressman Oberstar has got going, you know, focusing on bicycle transit connections. But unfortunately, we don't qualify for those funds because we're not adjacent to Minneapolis.
Representative Wagenius?
Yes. I think we should be paying more attention to the use of bicycles for commuting. And I think it would be hard for you to come up with a number, but just to have a sense that these bicycle links, I mean, there are trails that are in rural areas that are used for one thing, but trails that are used in a more congested area that are used in a completely different way. And I think we sometimes get them mixed up. I mean, because it used to be that folks in Minneapolis did not commute by bicycle, but now we're certainly working on that, and then we start thinking about what really makes it easy for people to commute by bicycle. Are there racks at Northtown Mall, or is it a safe place to leave the bikes? Or those are the things that I start to think about now.
Mr. Fulton?
Madam Chair, committee members, we've been in the process of holding a series of neighborhood meetings. We just completed the fifth of seven meetings that we've had with Coon Rapids residents. We've been very impressed and happy that at each of these meetings we'll get about 100 people out. And I just wanted to share with you the themes of our meetings. They really fall in three categories. One is transportation. I'm not here to talk about transportation, although it fits very nicely in your comments about the multimodal type of getting folks around. The second is the completion of trails and making the community more pedestrian-friendly, particularly as you cross very busy streets like Coon Rapids Boulevard, 85th, Foley Avenue, Northdale Boulevard. Coon Rapids is a fully developed community and has all of the kind of agonies that you have being fully developed in a suburban community where sidewalks in every street, on every street just hasn't happened. The third theme is more recent with all the snowfall. I consider Coon Rapids a bus-free community. What I mean by that is in order to take a bus to an elementary school, you've got to pay a few hundred bucks because you live within 2 miles of the elementary school. There's an elementary school that's in this area, and it certainly isn't tied directly into this request in front of you this afternoon, but it's a very important thing to recognize that what's going on with the kids in these heavy snowfalls, they're out on the street walking, not on the sidewalks because we haven't plowed them yet, but they're walking along these major arteries to get to their elementary schools. And I have probably personally handled no fewer than 6 calls on that particular issue alone. So these trail connections and the ability to keep the kids off of the roads so they can get to and from school is a really important aspect. These trail connections are really important. I should also just remind the committee members that we have 2 commuter rail stops that will one that's been approved on the North Star commuter rail. The Foley commuter rail stop is not an approved stop, but probably within the next decade will. It's immediately north of this trail system, so folks who are trying to access that commuter rail system will certainly benefit by having this trail available.
Representative Solberg.
Madam Chair, Representative Portman, or somebody, on the map that I have in here, it's a little bit tough to, does the current trail go over the railroad tracks?
Madam Chair, Representative Solberg, the city of Fridley got funding from the federal government and has already negotiated with BNSF to cross the railroad tracks. So they've taken care of really the most difficult piece in doing that. But I did want to add on the school piece is, you see that circled area on your map and that number 132? Mm-hmm. There are children living underneath that number 132 in between East River Road and the railroad tracks who go to Adams Elementary School that's two blocks north. And right now there is no sidewalk out of their community going to their school.
Madam Chair, I want to understand, is the proposal to then start from the what I would think is the west side of the railroad tracks to and including where?
Including, just there's this, it would go to East River Road, okay. And then there's a tiny little piece on the northern side of that park that connects it to the Mississippi Trail.
Okay.
And that piece is about 75 feet long.
Representative Murphy?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Madam Chair, I just want to comment on you, the sidewalk isn't plowed, but now the trail is going to be plowed for the kids in a snowstorm like today.
Mr. Fulton.
Madam Chair, committee members, you're raising a very important point. It really goes back to trying to increase the amount of resources that we have to be able to plow snow of this magnitude in a reasonable amount of time. It's one of the challenges that we have as a community, especially with these types of snowfalls. Effectively, what's happened, and it happens in all fully developed communities, as the plows come by, they plow the snow onto the sidewalks. If you have adjacent developed properties, the folks that are plowing those parking lots after or maybe before we have plowed, we'll plow all that parking lot on that parking lot snow onto the sidewalks. So we need to actually use a snow blower as opposed to a plow, and we can walk faster than we can blow snow. And so you're bringing up a very valid point. There's no assurance that we're going to have the sidewalk plowed, but in the absence of a trail, the kids will be walking on the street or hiking above the mounds of snow.
We have just one practical question. Should this go forward, and we would need language for, is this the total cost or half of it?
This would be for the total cost.
For the total, because then language would have to specify that, because otherwise, we'll just have to make a note to make certain that we understand that it is for the total cost. I thank you for bringing this issue forward.
Thank you.
And in spite of the weather that you managed to come down, we hope you can return home. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
And our apologies to Representative Saylor and Representative Erdahl. We will work these two bills into a future meeting. In both of their cases, they had no testifiers, so we'll have to figure out another way. We had a couple of these that were just a little more complicated than we realized they were.
To put these in our pod.
That's a good idea. We'll capture those handouts. Meeting is adjourned.